may I please have your attention? For your security and safety, please leave the building immediately. Again, please leave the building immediately.
Welcome to the Nevermore podcast. We're recording inside the bunker today as we talk about apocalypse, dystopia, and utopia. The Nevermore podcast is a production of the Three Little Sisters, an independent publisher. We bring you stories from authors all over the globe that focus on important things that are creative, like fantasy, fiction, and all stories that matter. Our house welcomes authors of all different varieties from all different backgrounds, so come and check us out and find out what kind of things we take an interest in at www.littlesisters.com. Today on the program, we have our executive coordinator, Chiel Luyan-Berube, and our creative director, Sarah Strickland. Welcome to the program, ladies.
Hello.
Hey there.
So today on the program, we are discussing two little fantastic sort of sub-genres, I guess you could say, the dystopia and utopia. So I thought it would be kind of fun if we took sort of polar opposite sides here and say which one might be better and sort of why. So let's take the side of dystopia. Do we think this system would be better for people in general? And why would you say it would be better? Let's take the position of dystopia being positive.
If you could take the position of being positive,
if you could
of
take
course.
The position of dystopia being positive, yes.
Well, what's positive about dystopia? You get to murder people without repercussion, perhaps. I mean, Negan would say that would be an absolute positive. If you're talking Walking Dead, me personally, I think dystopia is better. There's no rules. You can write whatever you want. You can do whatever you want with this dystopian story.
Yeah, you have a completely clean slate to just, you know, make new rules or just have it be absolute anarchy and chaos. So it's definitely a lot easier to write, I think.
And you could theoretically, if you wanted to, although it would kind of bleed into utopia, is make dystopia positive. Dystopians don't always have to be negative. Dystopians could favor a particular group. They could be polar opposite to the world in which we live. So they could be counterintuitive to what we know now, but that doesn't mean necessarily that it would be negative. For example, you could build a dystopian future in which there would be a greater amount of animals versus humans. Does that mean it would be negative? Not necessarily. So it doesn't always mean that it has to be complete chaos, but it definitely means that it could change the overall scope of population or, you know, the landscape.
I tend to agree with you. I mean, look at our current situation on the planet Earth. What are we now? Are we getting closer to the 9 billion mark, I would think? I mean, that's a lot of people on one little planet. Mm-hmm. Dystopia, if there were, say, a nuclear explosion that took out 3/4 of the population. Now the resources are a little bit spread out differently. So you could focus on that kind of positivity. Mind you, a nuclear explosion isn't exactly a positive per se.
Exactly. And thus, what you could do is turn that dystopia into something positive, like a new beginning, a new rising, maybe a return to humanity's beginnings. For example, I don't know if anyone out there has been watching the original series on Apple Plus called C-S-E-E. It's with Jason Momoa. It's kind of an interesting idea on a somewhat, I would say, bordering between dystopia and utopia. It's a world that was built based on humans that have lost their sight due to a virus. So none of the humans that exist right now can see. And they are all blind, and they have to stumble around the world with no vision. So they rely on their hearing, on other senses to live. And in this world, they have basically set up a tribal society in which they all have to work together to figure out how to eat, how to build, how to live with no vision at all. And it was kind of, it's a very interesting show to see how human beings would survive under those conditions.
That does sound interesting.
Yeah, and I won't spoil what sort of the basis of the show, but it's really fascinating if you wanted to get into the mindset of kind of from an anthropological standpoint, what it would be like to watch humans build up societies post, you know, some viral thing that would change the way in which we survive today.
It also changes the way evolution took a turn.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. They evolved basically to be without sight at that matter. I mean, another good utopian example is Walking Dead. I mean, they took something, a viral infection that turned their dead into, well, walkers and people munchers. And they changed it with their own situation with making their own societies and even displayed human tendency for war in that TV series. Another one is the one with the deaf girl and the aliens, Quiet Place, Bird Box. They're all prime examples as dystopia turned to a positive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're showing the you that our disabilities may not be disadvantages, that there might be a place for all types of humans, no matter our ability or disadvantage. Our disadvantages might become advantages later on. So to not discount people just because they may not be as capable as we think that we need to be. I think a lot of times in survivalist scenarios, they kind of discount people with special needs or people with some kind of disadvantage, like people who may not have hearing or are blind, as not being, you know, ones that would be counted as ones that could survive apocalyptic type environments. But in effect, how do we even know that? And I think a lot of the dystopian literature allows us to explore, well, what ifs? And that's what I kind of like about dystopian novels, is it gives you that ability to kind of put these experiments out there and sort of say, well, what if you had humans that were all blind? Or what if you had humans that were 3/4 of the population was deaf? Or what if you had, you know, only women existed? Or what if you had, you know, all women and like 4 men? I mean, what would that universe look like?
That wouldn't be too good for the 4 men.
No, it wouldn't.
Right. But what would that world look like? You know, it's the same thing with, you know, Planet of the Apes. What would it be like if that evolutionary chain had reversed? So I think that these are kind of, you know, all kind of going into one of our points that we're going to talk about more in depth of using the thought experiment to kind of expand on what I'm trying to get to. But that's kind of the cool thing about dystopian themes, is it kind of gives you that scenario. What if we could do X or Y? But Sheila, you brought up a really good point there, that it seems like a lot of the dystopias kind of rely on either viral outbreaks and or war. Those seem to be two very common threads of how we get to the post-apocalypse.
Sometimes even relying on both. Again, Walking Dead relied on both.
Yeah.
The virus was the catalyst for what we're seeing in these last few seasons is war. And isn't that human nature? War.
And do you guys think now that we're in, you know, this era where climate change is becoming more in the limelight, that dystopians are going to be written with that as a factor as well? Like
absolutely.
I think back in the day it was too, like movies like Waterworld, even though that was not a very good film, and Running Man and stuff like that had climate change as a factor. And even like Hunger Games, climate change was a real factor in that film. And so I think that dystopians tend to, you know, use that as a catalyst for one of the reasons why, you know, we end up in our apocalypse.
I personally think that climate change was always an underlying written issue in most dystopian books from way back to right now. Not so much that it was right front and center, but it was one of the catalysts of most of the dystopian type books. It had to be, because your environment has to change, right?
Yeah, and like a lot of the times, you know, their environment becomes very desert-like, resources are very limited, you know, so there's always been an aspect of, you know, the climate has changed, things aren't growing anymore, food is, you know, hard to come by. I think that's always kind of been an element with dystopian fiction. But I think authors are going to start finding new spins on it. Now that it's
absolutely, I agree with you.
Yeah.
And just to make mention, this month is also NaNoWriMo, and if you have, and nobody has noticed, I've been participating in NaNoWriMo, and it just so happens that the book that I'm using, or writing rather, is a dystopian version book. When you talk about climate change, food resources. Right now, in my written work that I'm working on, the food resource is the major issue and causes a massive conflict between the one side and the other side.
Which is a really good thing to focus on, because that is going to become an issue. We have a lot of issues here in the United States with food deserts, and I know that Canada has some areas that are considered to be food deserts, and there's many places in the third world that are extensive food deserts. And that is becoming an issue as food is getting harder to grow because of climate problems. And it's going to be harder to get food in through, you know, just through trade routes. So it becomes a more and more difficult to grow food, to import food. So finding alternative sources of food are going to become hugely important in the future.
And I think all of that, on top of that, to reiterate your point is, well, if the stronger side, or the one with the more guns, takes over and steals half the weaker side's food, they're going to have starvation problems. They're the ones who are food poor, because the other people are taking it out from underneath them.
Exactly. And I think that violence is going to be a huge thing that humans are going to have to come to grips with. And it's going to be somewhat interesting, in my opinion, to contemplate what the edge push is going to look like. Is it going to be a violent revolution, or is it going to be a moment in which our humanity shines through and our hand reaches out to those who need it? And we realize that by us coming together, we can build a better future. And this is where I think we can now go to the flip side on why my optimist side would love to believe that the utopia is somewhat better. For me, I would love to imagine the world in which we could all live kumbaya and peace, and that there would be this perfect world in which we embrace the fact that we need to do something to fix our planet and come together to do that. And so me being the slimy, tiny bit of optimist that I am, likes to believe and hope in the utopia. And I kind of like films that kind of push that idea. For me, my most, I think the best film for me to watch to keep my hopes up was Cloud Atlas, because it showed me, even though the film is kind of, I mean, I'm kind of stretching its example of utopia here, but to me, it was a connected thread of showing our humanity throughout. It showed you that we can try our best to really be there for each other and to survive. And sometimes we have to make choices to do that. And sometimes those choices are hard. And I think that for me, like those are films that I kind of cling to, you know, the hope, the vision, the future that, you know, everyone becomes, I don't know, I guess I'm just like a Star Trek utopian.
Speaking of Star Trek, I was just about to mention Star Trek.
Yeah.
The pessimist in me says that the human race is too stupid to even get there, but the optimist in me says that we can achieve Star Trek level peace and harmony. And the realist in me says, not in my lifetime, unfortunately. Hopefully, my children's.
I see too many power struggles possible. You know, it's like, I would love to think that, you know, everybody could just kind of come together and, you know, everybody has their victory garden and everybody teaches everybody the resource gathering skills and the survival skills. But it's like, the realist in me is like, there would be a power struggle somewhere.
Always. You know? Look at China.
Yeah.
China right now is exhibiting that very point in going from communism to democracy, or trying to anyway.
Yeah.
But I think that this is the why I kind of feel like there's a possibility of utopia, because I kind of look at the world right now and I see young people and the vision that they have for their future. And I kind of see this little fire burning in them that I saw when my parents were beginning to fight. And I think that fight and that passion in the belly of like, I'm sick of the system that exists. I'm sick of the world that I see around me. And I'm going to do everything in my power to make it different. The things that we fought for in the 90s, in the 2000s, they're picking up the mantle of what we left and kind of pushing forward. You look at Greta Thunberg. I mean, I haven't seen a child like that in decades. And it's nice to see them picking up the passion and kind of like pushing adults to be like, we need to, like, they shouldn't be doing that. They should be in school. We should be the ones fighting for them. And it kind of becomes inspiring for me to realize that maybe there's a chance that these children will make us wake up and go, okay, how do we get together here? And obviously we're never going to all get what we want, but there's got to be a way forward. And that's what I kind of cling on to hope for. I just, you know, I think humans have always been on this knife's edge of like, it could be really bad. And then we seem to bounce back from that edge. And I'm just hoping we see that bounce back, you know, so that we don't slip off into the oblivion, as they say. So that's just my hope. I try to stay to that pure optimist because dystopians scare me to death. So like, I don't really want, you know, I don't really want dystopia. I kind of like utopias to a degree. I think that you can have too much of a utopia. So, you know, a utopia within reason. I wouldn't want like freedom to be quashed in any way.
Well, take a look at that one movie. What was it called? To make your point about that too much of utopia. The one where the he was this whole universe, they couldn't show emotion and they actually had to take medication to keep emotions in check. You know, art was destroyed, books were burned, the Mona Lisa was burned, and they literally had these people hunting down the revolution of emotion.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't because even remember. They were Christian that, Bale know, was in
show
the movie.
Anger or something, yeah. And that it would disrupt the balance. And
and they had that Russian gun kata stuff in it for fighting scenes and katanas. And it was a pretty decent movie. And for the life of me, I can't remember the name.
Me neither.
That sounds really interesting. But yeah, like exactly what you just said. Like, you could create a utopia where it becomes the control on keeping it pure or good becomes too much. And then freedom is the price that you pay for that utopia. So I wouldn't want that either. And I think the same could be true in both scenarios, whether it's dystopian or utopia, even in a dystopia where you have full chaos and everybody can do whatever you want. But that doesn't really give you full freedom, because then you don't have the freedom of personhood. And because your personhood is constantly under threat by everyone else. Right. So you don't really have like the freedom to live, the freedom to worship, the freedom to like walk down the street, because you don't know if your neighbor's, you know, going to decide that they like your house and take it from you that day. So it's not necessarily the better of the scenarios either. I think somewhere maybe, I don't even know if there's a middle there, but I think some kind of like, I think just an open actual democracy would be nice, and where we actually had laws that were just for both the rich and the poor, and there was some economic justice too. And
I'd like to see gender neutral laws, quite frankly.
Yeah. And that's what I was just going to say, like gender equality, equal rights for everyone. And that's where I feel like we could be on the right path. And no more like rights for any religious order, no matter who you are. Like, that's where I kind of feel like we could be a little, like, you're free to do whatever you want, but no more like, no more laws that would be like, oh, protecting this religious institution. Like, you can go worship whatever you want, but
that should be a given right in the first place, where you don't need a law for that. I mean, I'm not gonna crap down.
I just don't want it in my
throat of someone else. Right. What I believe, as long as you know they don't do it to me. You're entitled to your belief.
I kind of like the original rules that we had, where it was like, you have the freedom to worship and do whatever you want, but there's a secular world. And we just need to keep the secular world and the religious world separate. And
state
that's okay.
And belief should be two separate things, or rather state and religion, because belief and religion are two different things as well.
And now we are probably going to get millions of hate comments. Okay, so moving on to... So when we talk about where these genres kind of stem from, when I was doing research on both dystopia and utopias, the kind of interesting thing is that both of these... genres actually stem quite far back, as far as I could tell, almost before the ancient Greeks, somewhere around Egyptian era, is when you had this sort of idea of formulating possibilities of human futures. And this really was because of the fact of the invention of technologies. Now, when I use the word technologies, I know everyone's going to be like, oh, do you believe that, you know, ancient Egyptians had machines? No, but they had technologies that would have improved their lives. For example, the wheel would have been a technology. You know, movable carts would have been a technology.
Batteries. So, they had their own version of batteries, too. Some of them still work even when they found them.
So there was technologies for using that word that would have improved their lives. As soon as humans started using technological improvements or things that would improve their lives, they started imagining what would happen if those technologies went awry. And that's where you started to get dystopian novels or dystopian stories actually being told. So you get a lot of destruction mythology being written about, where the gods got angry about machines being built, or the gods got angry with humans inventing these technological marvels. You know, the story of Icarus being the most famous one, where he built this ability to fly into the sun, and of course his wings melted and, you know, he died. And so you get this idea that, like, you can reach too far, humanity can go too far, and that there's a price to be paid. And the same with utopia. When Plato started theorizing the possibility of human exploration and invention, and he started imagining what humans could be capable of, he wrote writing about Atlantis. That's where we kind of get the idea of where utopian came from. So that's sort of where the two genres come from. And then they kind of like spurred all over the world. But most cultures have both a dystopian myth and a utopian myth. And it's kind of interesting when you go into each culture to see what their vision of human dystopian and utopian futures are, because they're very, very different from each other. And all of them usually involve a human that either went too far or didn't go far enough. And it's kind of interesting to see, like, the paradigm of, like, knowing too much or not knowing enough. And kind of interesting if you kind of dig around in the culture to see what kind of, you know, genres kind of inspire you. So when you're doing your research into writing, go back in history and kind of take a look at the mythology, because you're going to find some links there into dystopia and utopias.
I'll take your comments. Oh, go ahead, Sarah. You first. I'm always butting in.
Oh, it's okay. I like how it's always been a running theme that people love technology, but they're also afraid of it. And there's always that fear of going too far and creating something that just destroys everything. And it's like, I just find it so interesting that that's kind of been going on since, you know, ancient times, where people are just like, what if we go too far?
Well, and I'll reiterate that statement too. Look at Apocalypto. That's even before the ancient Egyptians. It shows that using tools or technology advanced human life. I mean, that's Aztec level there. And, you know, one side goes way too far by creating slaves and then sacrificing them because, ooh, the rain didn't come. Mm-hmm. So it mixes that kind of dystopian, utopian theme together, more dystopian, mind you, if you ask the losing side, unfortunately. And it's about, like, you know, a guy struggled to get back to his own family.
Mm-hmm.
After they decide to capture him, sacrifice him, and, you know, it's from Mayan times, Yucatan times, you know, and that's even before the Egyptians. I think also that, you know, cavemen, when they started using tools, it's the same theme. So all the way back to even when we first started as a species, that theme has been right beside us.
Although when you do anthropological research, although you could probably start around the Aztecs, when you look at like cavemen and pre, I guess you would say pre, I don't know,
pre-hunter-gatherer?
Yeah. Most of the societies up until that point didn't actually think past, you know, seasonal. So there's no, as far as I can tell in my research, and maybe some archaeologist out there who knows better than I do can point me in a direction, but I couldn't find any evidence of cave paintings or archaeological findings that showed any evidence that they believed in a somewhat like dystopian future. The best I could find was that they did believe in cataclysmic futures. So they believed that like a volcano could explode and they would all die, but they didn't have like a utopian vision. So, and honestly, I believe that's because they really, their lifespan was so short that I don't even think that was a thought. If you live to tomorrow, that was your utopia. I don't think there was
a, your like point. If you lived through a winter, that was pretty much, yeah, you were
golden. If a saber-toothed tiger ate you for dinner, right, then you were done.
Exactly. So I think for them, their dystopia was more like the volcano exploded and our whole tribe died. That was bad. But there wasn't really much of a vision of like, oh, someday we're going to find this green pasture and it's all going to be deer that we can eat until we, you know, become fat and have women and children abundant. Like, there wasn't, like, as far as I know, but I mean, I could be completely wrong, and I would love for somebody out there who does more archaeological digs, if you got some information to share, I would love to read it, because I'm always on the hunt for, like, I love history, and as a author, I feel like going back farther in time gives you links to our humanity. And that really helps when you're writing apocalyptic themes, because when you're writing these themes, I feel like the number one goal is to show your humanity in this, because you have to show why your character would feel loss or feel not loss from the world that they are currently living in. So you have to show why that they would have these sort of characteristics and these feelings like anger and hatred and maybe violence. What is it about human beings that makes us like this? And we can look back to our tribal ancestors to understand what it was like to live in a landscape that our dystopian or utopian future would be similar to. Because it would be like putting us back exactly as it was back in the world when there wasn't technology, back in the world in which you had to survive. And that gives you a different type of human. It gives you a different type of person, a different type of mindset, where you have to think like 1 minute to the next, 1 day to the next, and that's a totally different thing. It's not like you do today, where you just get in your car and go down to Safeway and grab yourself a couple of steaks. This is like full on thinking like, how am I going to find food? How am I going to hunt it? And how am I going to survive? So I think it's good to look into the past. So as we kind of move through this discussion now, we're going to discuss the use of the thought experiment. So in most of the dystopian and utopian writings that I have been researching, most of the authors really seem to hone in on the use of thought experiments. For example, if we use The Handmaid's Tale, the thought experiment was really for Margaret Atwood. She based this on history. But her thought experiment was, what if those historical examples had gone too far? So she used this model that she had found of this group in America, of which this one group had been controlling women's reproductive cycles. That's her basis for The Handmaid's Tale. And she imagined about what would happen if that group had actually taken over the entire United States. So what do you think the importance of thought experiments are when you are considering dystopia and utopia? How important is it for authors to kind of put a thought experiment out there to begin writing this type of genre?
I'd say it's a pretty big tool in the toolbox for something like dystopian, utopian writing. Even under the main category of apocalyptic writing. I mean, thought experiments make you think, right? That's their main goal. They make you think of all the angles, the ins and outs, and writing about them before you actually use them in your plot or, you know, to build your story with.
And Sarah, any thoughts?
I think it makes for a very interesting story if, you know, you have a really big what if.
Exactly. I totally agree. So let's go on to, we mentioned a lot of film and TV references, and I think we kind of summed up a few of those. We mentioned The Walking Dead as being a good one, Hunger Games, The Running Man. I mentioned the original Apple TV special called C. It's really good for people who want to check that out. There's also Carnival Row and even His Dark Materials. If anybody is kind of interested in the Golden Compass series, it is kind of a sort of a split world kind of theory, which is kind of somewhat in the apocalyptic genre, believe it or not. Most of the time in this dystopian utopian genre, it kind of spreads into sci-fi a little bit, but it has various tendrils. And one of the tendrils that I've found it connects to is anything that split worlds. So it could have wormholes where you have world one that looks a certain way, and then there's like a mirror world that looks a different way. So for example, if anybody knows the Golden Compass series, it was that children have demons or souls that live outside the body and in the form of an animal. And they can see, some of the people can see the regular human world in which our souls are within the body. So it's this kind of split world where there's regular humans living in this world in this timeline, and then these other humans living in another timeline where magic and dwarves and elves and all these other things exist. So there's that kind of thing. The same with Carnival Row. It's like elves and humans living side by side. So apocalypse type themes actually do kind of tendril into this. Is there any other film or TV references that you guys can kind of...
Oh, I've got like a whole bunch of them. There's
Mad
everything
Mad,
from...
Mad Max, yes.
Mad Max.
Yes, Mad Max, absolute classic. You've got your Earth Abides, Oryx and Crake, another Margaret Atwood book. I Am Legend, both the book and the movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
the Postman.
One, yeah.
You've got The Death of Grass, some really old ones. You've got your, oh God, there's so many.
Yeah. Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, you got your Metro 2033, Helldivers. You've got, these are all books, by the way. Blood Red Road, The Alchemist. Turbulent, The Curse. Oh, I could keep going if you want.
But any of those would be really good to start.
Atlantis would be a good example of a utopian
movie. Oh, yes, that would be great.
My favorite, though, out of the bunch would definitely be The Stand. The TV movie was great. I love Gary Sinise. He did a really good job. So did the lady who did Mother Abigail, I believe it is. My brain fart if it isn't. I'm sorry. It's been a while since I've actually read the book and seen the movie. But the book is just, it's about a virus that kills off most of the population of the planet, and this one woman draws everyone to her on the good side, and then you've got Randall Flagg on the other side, and my favorite character, Trash Can Man. My life is yours, my life for you. I love Trash Can Man. He just absolutely makes me giggle, and that's like the epitome of, you know, dystopian, inner dystopia from the mind, right? Complete and utter craziness, if you will. That's a mental health issue right there for Trash Can Man, like schizophrenic style. And that ties into today's day and age where mental health is frowned upon and looked at as dystopia. And again, reiterating your idea of disability isn't always disability. It could very well be ability. I mean, Trash Can Man did bring him the nuke that he wanted to use to blow everybody up. So,
yeah, there's also like old school shows like The Dollhouse, where she was a robot that had to, well, a human that was brainwashed into believing that she was other people. That was a really interesting show. Totally dystopian. Very cool. And this is why I said, like, the tendrils of dystopia and utopian apocalyptic fiction do really spread into sci-fi. So a lot of it is mixed together. Also, The Time Machine really does mix into these genres and kind of shows you possible futures.
Especially if you're messing with the past, right?
Oh, The Matrix. Yeah, the Matrix is good.
Because that's just a repeat of that dystopia, right? The Matrix, and it just keeps going. And you find out at the end of the last one, the third one, that yes, it's just something that keeps happening in their system because nobody's learned. Program hasn't fixed itself, and it can't.
Yeah, so these are all things that you can just kind of like get your jump off and kind of dive in, because the tendrils of this go on forever, and you can find links to a lot of these like everywhere. And we all trying to like compile some of the references that we've made in the podcast below in the description on YouTube. So as we kind of get into the end of this podcast, we're going to talk about, do you think that apocalyptic fiction is a form of prophecy? This is actually something that has come up a few times in my reading on apocalyptic fiction. A lot of people like to think that writers of this genre are prophets in a way. Look at Margaret Atwood, for example. I'm going to bring her up again. Because of what she wrote, a lot of women feel like we are living very close to The Handmaid's Tale. We see systematically women's rights being repealed in many countries, including here in the United States. And women are now walking around wearing, you know, handmade garments everywhere. Is this a sign that some authors are able to predict the future because they are actually speaking about the past? We just don't remember it because it's not being taught to us anymore. We're being systematically whitewashed, to use that word, for history. And so we are not being told about our past. And so when we see the future being repeated again and again and again, we don't remember that this happened before. And so it seems like these authors are prophets or like prophetically telling us the future.
I would say that, yeah, for the most part, it's more of it prophesizes that human beings don't learn from their mistakes right away, and they keep repeating those mistakes. Let's take another example other than women's rights. How about Native American rights? Look at the residential schools, especially for Canada's side. That was a big, huge discrepancy for Canada. Right now it's Aboriginal women that are going missing or being murdered, and nobody's talking about it. We're repeating history again, and we're not learning from our mistakes. So yes, that's self-prophesizing.
Yeah, I don't know if I would necessarily say that these authors are, you know, prophets, but I think there are certain themes that they touch on that, you know, it historically speaking, this is where we're heading, you know, using up all the resources because we aren't learning that, hey, resources are limited. You know, so it's, I think a lot of the themes they're touching on are, you know, based on that whole, you know, we're just not learning fast enough that, you know, history is going to repeat itself. But I don't know that it's necessarily, you know, them having supernatural abilities.
No, I do not believe that they have supernatural abilities, but one thing I do think that is happening, and this is where I feel that is true, is that it's purposeful ignorance on the part of society, mm-hmm. in that we are purposefully dumbing down people so that we don't remember our history. Mm-hmm. We don't remember that this happened before. We don't remember the residential schools. We don't remember that we used resources up before. You know, I'm a child who grew up during a period of time in which the Cold War was a real thing. I am that old to remember that. And I remember when I was a kid living in Ontario, hearing the air raid sirens go off and fearing that there was going to be a nuclear war. And if you ask any kid today if they remember like the Cold War in the 90s, I don't even think it was even talked about.
Yeah, I don't think so.
And this is what I mean. Like we wipe out our history. We don't go enough in the past to remember what it was that happened to those societies. Why did they collapse? And I hope that we can continue now that we have more access to information, that increases our desire to go backwards a little bit and kind of like look at our history and remember what it was that we lost so that we can, you know, learn from our mistakes and kind of go forward and change our future. Because it does take all of us, as they say, it takes a village to make change. And it's going to take all of us to work together to make a future that's going to be, you know, remotely positive. And that's where I kind of feel authors of this genre are kind of reminding us that, hey, hello, you know, red flags, this happened before and you need to wake up, mm-hmm. because it's time to stop sleeping and do something. And I kind of feel that they're vastly important in the world of writing, in the world of film, because it scares you and it reminds you of like, I don't want to live in that future.
Yeah.
I don't want that. So what in the world do I have to do? Like, I'm signing up to protest today. Like, where do I have to go? What do I have to do? I'm signing up. Like, and I think that's a good thing. It kind of spurs you to do something positive. So on that note, is there anything else you want to say about the somewhat, I know this has kind of been a somewhat depressing, somewhat happy podcast, but you know, that's what talking about dystopia and utopian futures kind of are. It's somewhat happy and somewhat depressing.
A little bit.
And somewhere in between.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, then we're going to wrap up this podcast. The Three Little Sisters Publishing is focused on the mission of making books that showcase voices that would otherwise be ignored by mainstream publishers. Our mission is to make quality publications for readers of all ages. We apply our background in law, publishing, editing, and more to give a holistic approach to publishing. If you're interested in checking us out, please come to our website at www.littlesisters.com. And we'll see you on the next podcast where we will be diving into a much more happier theme and talking about the wonderful Victorian Christmas.